Geddy looked back at him with incredulity, but almost immediately his eyes jagged away from Walter and fixed on something over Walter's shoulder. Something, from the tracking of Geddy's eyes, that Walter could see was rapidly approaching them. Walter spun, bringing his rifle up at the hip, ready to let it eat into whatever was encroaching on them. A tiny gray solar. The windows were down. What the fuck was this? Stuffed into the vehicle like clowns in a tiny car were four hulking new breeds. Walter's finger twitched onto the trigger, started applying that rearward pressure. The car lurched to a stop adjacent to them. The new breed in the front passenger seat held his hands out the window and yelled, but Walter couldn't hear a damn word that he said, and the only reason that he didn't open up on them in a scathing barrage of rifle fire was because none of them wore their battle shrouds, and the sight of their faces caught him off guard. The pause in his trigger finger gave his mind enough time to recognize the face that stared at him. "Chief Gibbs?" Walter said, mystified. Chapter 12. "What the fuck are you doing here?" That was the first meaningful thing that Walter had to say. By that time, the perforated eardrums were half working again, enough that he could hear other people's voices through the humming, ringing noise if he listened carefully. The red zone of the city of Durham flew by them. Walter wasn't sure where Gibbs and his team of new breeds were taking them. Gibbs, Monty, Clay, and Harris. Four out of the six that made up the squad of new breeds run by Chief Kozlowski. Walter recognized them from Kanawha 3. In his dealings with Roy and Kaz, he'd met them several times, though they'd never actually spoken outside of greetings. If the little solar had been packed before, it was only made worse by the presence of three extra bodies. Harris drove. Gibbs was in the passenger seat. Perched uncomfortably on the center console was Geddy. In the back, Walter sat smashed in together with Clay and Monty, and Bobby lay woozily across their laps. Monty held her head and shoulders on the far side of the vehicle, keeping them elevated. Her feet were in Walter's lap. She was still out of it, but had managed to answer a quick run of cognitive questions. Her brain worked, but slow, like it was stuck in the mud. Gibbs was the one that answered Walter's question.
"Well, obviously we're here to save your asses. Where are we going?"
Walter blinked a few times. He was riotously confused, but he couldn't pick a question to ask. It seemed easier just to roll with it. His brain had also taken its own beating, although not as bad as Bobby's.
"Hold on."
He reached into his pants pocket with some painful shuffling effort and extracted the auto jack that Carolyn had slipped him just before she'd seemed to disappear off the face of the earth. "Go," she'd told him, and he'd gone. Up the steps towards the interior, and when he'd stood at the door and stopped and turned to see her one last time, she was no longer there, and Bobby had rushed him onwards.
"We got a safe house," Walter explained, his words still fuzzy. "That's where we're gonna go. I just gotta get the location of it."
"You don't know the location?"
"It was just given to me."
"By who?"
"My wife."
"Your wife?"
"Carolyn."
Gibbs just shook his head like he was trying to clear it.
"Okay, whatever. You sure it's safe?"
"Am I sure of anything? Of course I'm not."
"Yeah,"
Walter said, sticking the jack into the port of his PD.
"It's safe."
Walter flipped the monitor into the air in front of his face. The usual home screen came up, then it flashed and turned blank for a few seconds. That would be the auto jack doing its job, like a little cleaner coming in and wiping everything down. When the screen came to life, it was the basic default screen of a PD. It had only three applications available: phone, messenger, and maps. Walter swiped his finger over the maps icon. The location was saved, easy to pull up.
"It's outside of Durham," Walter said.
"Well, that's a start," Gibbs replied.
Geddy spoke up.
"How are we supposed to get out of the city?"
"Southwest," Gibbs said with confidence. 54 out towards Chapel Hill. It's a no man's land out there. Still a lot of innocent people, and they don't keep it patrolled. They do have birds in the air almost constantly, but that's the best we're gonna get."
Harris harumphed and shifted his grip on the wheel.
"Hope they don't notice a four-passenger car with seven people crammed in it."
Walter looked at the map. If they exited Durham out by Chapel Hill way, then they'd be going around their ass to get to their elbow. The safe house on the map was southeast of Durham, in a small suburban town that sat neatly between the Irbys and the borders of District 89.
"That's an hour detour," Walter pointed out.
"Well," Gibbs sighed, "we can always take a straight shot and die if you prefer that."
Walter held up a hand even though Gibbs couldn't see him.
"Easy, Chief. I was just pointing out that it's going to be an hour detour. Didn't say it was a bad idea.
Pretty much the only way out of the city.
How do you know?
We were shacked up with another resistance group, Gibbs explained. Old army buddy from before we all defected. He defected too, but didn't come with Colonel Wainwright's units. Decided to run off and do his own thing. I've been keeping tabs on him. Anyway, he was our only contact in Durham, and he had a good grasp of the situation here. Good intelligence, which makes sense since he was an intelligence officer. Route 54 was the best way out of Durham, according to his last intelligence.
Last? Walter questioned.
He's dead, Gibbs said without hesitation. Business as usual. Got hit by a rocket barrage from a flight of gunships 2 nights ago. Me and my guys weren't with him at the time. We were safe at his little base of operations, so we decided to stay there until we could get a handle on the situation.
Where was the base? Walter asked, genuinely curious.
Basement kitchen in a bombed-out hotel. Pretty nice, actually. Very defensible.
Ryan Barnes, Walter said.
Gibbs turned in his seat, one eyebrow up. Yeah. How'd you know?
We kept track of the other militia groups in the area. We wondered what had happened after he went dark.
Gibbs nodded, turned back around. Well, now you know.
Why were you in Durham in the first place?
Because we heard Kaz and Javon were in a heap of trouble down this way.
Walter jolted forward in his seat. Have you heard from them?
Yes. Managed to make contact just a few hours ago, right before we got sidetracked into this shitstorm.
Walter frowned. How'd you get involved in this?
Ted, Gibbs said. Ted the tech.
What?
Ted was one of Ryan's guys, a tech. He wasn't killed in the rocket attack. He monitors shit, hacks transmissions and stuff. Heard some squad-to-squad comms and figured out that you guys were about to get hit.
Walter just blinked a few times, processing like a slow computer.
Gibbs shifted in his seat. We figured we'd try to help pull some folks out of the fire. You're welcome.
Thank you, Getty said with syrupy cordiality.
Well, Gibbs cleared his throat. It's not entirely altruistic.
Oh, Getty replied, obviously not shocked.
We were hoping that whoever we rescued had a place to go, Monty spoke up.
Walter thought about how useful a squad of new breeds could be.
Well, that depends. Walter suddenly snapped the monitor shut, aware of the fact that he had not pulled up the exact address of the safe house just yet. He'd only had the waypoint displayed, so Monty, who sat next to him, could not know where the safe house was.
Gibbs's smile faltered. Then he stowed it away completely. He had a typically broad new breed's face. That was an effect of the body mods. But his eyes were recessed and dark. He looked like he had some Hispanic lineage, something from the Iberian Peninsula. His hair was dark, nearly black, graying at the edges. He was clean-shaven.
All right, he said. What does it depend on?
First off, Walter said, wrangling his tone to be a deadpan hard bargainer, you're gonna get Kaz and Javon from wherever they are. Where are they?
Gibbs made a raspberry sound. That goes without saying, Walt. That's the whole reason we're here. And they're just outside of Fayetteville.
Good. And once you get them...
Walter stifled the urge to swallow.
You all work for me.
Gibbs made another rude noise and turned his back on Walter. Jesus. You and your brother. The two of you. You know you're fucking peas in a pod, right? Always trying to work an angle. I really don't like that.
We gotta do what we gotta do, Walt replied.
Getty peeked over his shoulder at Walter. Their eyes met for a half second before Getty glanced away. Walter couldn't see his mouth, but his eyes said he was smiling. Why should we work for you? Gibbs demanded. You're just a fucking grower, Walt.
Walter shook his head. No, Gibbs. There's more to it than that, and you know it. I have connections that you don't have. And besides all of that, where else are you gonna go?
Gibbs huffed and looked out the window. To his credit, he knew his situation and didn't dilly-dally around with it. Right, he said finally. Sure, Walt. You got us by the short and curlies, I guess. We need food and we need shelter. We got nowhere else to go. There. You happy?
Walter ignored him. Gibbs, I know you don't believe me right now, but you're eventually gonna thank me for this.
Gibbs just nodded, unconvinced. Kay. Kaz and Javon were almost to their stolen car when the message came in on their stolen PD. Everything stolen from James, of course.
James, Macy's lackluster boyfriend. The two new breeds approached the car with as much nonchalance as two body-modded super soldiers could muster. The car was exactly what Kaz had expected it to be, a late-model beige-colored solar sedan. A bland car and a bland color for a bland person. Kaz sneered at it as he approached. The PD that he'd stolen from James's arm chirped in his pocket. He stopped at the driver's door and pulled the PD out to look at the message. He registered the approach of another car and decided not to react to it. Better just to act natural. He was just a guy checking his PD before he got in his car. Just a really large guy. Been delayed. With your friends. Need to talk. Kaz's fiery eyebrows furrowed over his ice cube eyes. Change of plans, he said, looking up at Javon from over the top of the car. But Javon wasn't looking at Kaz. He was looking over Kaz's shoulder. Heads up, Javon murmured.
Kaz!
A voice of feminine ire snapped at him. Kaz twitched at the sound of it and turned. As he turned, he smiled as charmingly as he was able.
Ah, Macy, you're home early.
Macy was in her small GUV. Her windows were rolled down. She was in the driver's seat, looking across the car through the open passenger's window. She glared at Kaz, both hands white-knuckling the steering wheel.
What are you...
Her eyes widened.
Is that James's car?
Kaz looked at the car as though he wasn't sure.
Yeah, he decided after a moment's hesitation. He's letting us borrow it.
That was bullshit. James had been highly uncooperative. It had to take the PD and the key fob to the car against his will. He was now tied up with fashionable belts harvested from Macy's wardrobe, gagged with a pair of her socks. Macy ripped her way out of the car, not even bothering to roll up the windows. She slammed doors and stalked around the front of her car to where she stood beside Kaz with her hands on her hips, a chihuahua growling at a mastiff.
That's fucking bullshit,
she hissed at Kaz.
Where is he?
James? Kaz asked. He's hanging out upstairs. Relax.
You're so full of shit.
Kaz just sighed.
What are you doing with a guy like that anyways?
A guy like what?
Her voice inched up towards yelling, though she was obviously trying to restrain herself from making a scene.
A nice guy? A sensitive guy? Someone who...
She stopped herself and held up a hand like a crossing guard halting traffic.
No. No, I'm not doing this with you right now, Kaz. What the hell did you do to him? Did you hurt him?
Kaz glanced at the upstairs apartment, trying to think if he had actually injured James.
No, he said and nodded confidently. No, I did not.
Macy plunged fingers into her hair and whispered under her breath,
I should have never got involved. I told myself, Macy, don't get involved in this.
She extracted the hand from her head and drew herself up.
Both of you, back upstairs right now.
Kaz cast a glance to Javon. Javon pursed his lips and shrugged, tossing the decision back to Kaz.
You know, Kaz said, we were actually just trying to leave.
You're not going to steal my boyfriend's car.
Borrow.
Steal, and probably get it blown up.
Kaz shrugged. She had a point there. In fact, he hadn't really planned on returning it. In the interest of operational security, he'd planned on detonating the battery banks. To cover their tracks, of course.
Kaz looked back at Javon. The crew is sidetracked. We need to get indoors until we get back with them and figure out what's going on. They say they're with our friends.
Javon quirked an eyebrow.
Walt?
Kaz shook his head.
No idea.
Can we please,
Macy grated,
get inside?
Kaz turned to her and made a gracious usher's gesture.
After you, then.
She stared death at him and then turned and went for the stairs. Kaz and Javon followed after her.
Listen, Kaz soothed. Don't get mad, okay?
I'm already mad, Kaz,
she snapped.
Well,
he bobbed his head as they started up the stairs again.
Don't get madder.
Macy spun to look at him, then stopped herself and raised both hands in a sort of irritable surrender and started marching up the stairs again, shaking her head.
Chapter 13.
They were hemorrhaging. That's all Carolyn could think of. They were hemorrhaging and she needed to stop the bleeding. The second she'd released Walter, Carmichael had appeared and hooked an arm into hers, spun her around, and plunged into the flow of people. By the time Carolyn looked back over her shoulder to get one last glimpse of Walter, she was too far around the corner of the building. Carmichael had piled her roughly into the car and then got in the driver's seat. Like a bodyguard, when his charge has been attacked, he was just trying to get distance. There was a focused, feverish urgency to what he was doing, even while Carolyn sat in a sort of daze. "Wake up," she told herself. "No time to be dazed." He'd cranked the car, and someone outside had hollered at them, asking if they had room for one more, because everyone was looking for a way out of that place before the coax troops hit in full force. But Carmichael ignored whoever it was, and they rocketed out of the parking lot like they were trying to set a land speed record. "Shouldn't have come here," Carmichael griped, but that was all he said. He turned them north, a left out of the parking lot, and they hauled ass to safer places. Durham was getting crushed. The resistance in Durham was hemorrhaging, and it wouldn't be long before they were bled dry. Mel's outfit had been one of the strongest out there, and now they were scattered like dandelion fluff in the wind. Carolyn swore and thought about punching the seat in front of her. Carmichael had piled her into the back, but she just didn't have the energy. It was like every ounce of go juice in her body had been redirected to her brain, trying to figure out what the hell she was going to do now. If the resistance in Durham was snuffed out, then there would never be a need for the coax to empty out their troop reserves held at Coax County, the Sino-Russian military reserve in the middle of the boonies of Georgia. And if they never emptied out Coax County, then the UDI organization and the renegade troops hiding in the mountains of West Virginia would never have a chance of taking that place over. And if they never took Coax County over, then the Coax troop surge would still have its landing and distribution hub, and in all likelihood, despite the fact that the international community was frowning and hemming and hawing over it, the Russians and the Chinese would go through with the troop surge. And when that happened, this little upstart rebellion would be crushed. Any chance of kicking the coalition out of the country and becoming once again a sovereign and independent nation would be snuffed out. There were millions of civilians waiting to fight. There were the renegades, 10% of the federal military that were waiting to strike, and there were so many other bits of the Fed military that were waiting to defect. If only there would be some sign of victory on the horizon. If only they could knock Coax County out of commission, then the tide would turn. Bigger and bigger portions of the standing federal military would defect and fight for the resistance. And when that happened, it would be a landslide. Everyone would fight. And then the Coax would have to admit that they were officially at war with the American people. And they wouldn't do that. It wasn't in their economic interests. But it was all a pipe dream if they couldn't bluff the Coax into dumping everything they had into Durham. And their bluff was failing right now. It was showing weakness. Why should Carolyn even care? Why not just run off with Walter now that she'd found him? Well, as tempting as that was, they were both fugitives. They were both wanted by the Coax, and until the Coax was illegitimized, their status as fugitives would remain. As long as the Coax remained on American soil, Carolyn and Walter had no hope of amnesty. They could run, but they'd spend the rest of their lives looking over their shoulders. No, it was not an option. The only option was to make this bluff happen. The only option was to convince the Coax that they had to shove everything they had into quelling the resistance in Durham.
"I can't sell it with what I have,"
Carolyn suddenly shouted. Carmichael jumped in the driver's seat.
"What?"
Carolyn looked at him piercingly.
"I can't fucking convince the Coax to shove a bunch of troops in here when we're bleeding to death and everyone fucking knows it. We look weak right now. Why the hell would the Coax send reinforcements when what they have on the ground right now is doing the job of killing us so goddamn well? Huh?"
Carmichael faced forward. "Don't yell at me about it, Ms. Udy." Carolyn grit her teeth at the name again.
"I need fighters. I need supplies. I need strength. I have none of it right now. Your boss won't send it to me, and neither will my own parents. They keep telling me to make do, make do. Am I insane?"
She leaned forward, crowding over Carmichael's shoulder.
"Is it me? Am I insane, Carmichael? Or do you see our chances how I see them?"
Carmichael didn't answer, which was answer enough. Carolyn shook her head.
"We can't just make do."
She looked out the window, shaking her head at the ruins of the city that passed her by.
"You can't sell a bluff by betting the minimum amount. You gotta go all in."
A glance in the rearview mirror. "And what's that mean, all in?" Carolyn looked at him pointedly.
"It means the renegades."
"They'll never go for it."
"Yeah, I know. I've had the conversation before. But do you honestly see us surviving the month with what we have right now?"
She waved a hand in the air.
"Fuck money. Fuck supplies."
She jabbed her index finger into the back of his seat.
"If we don't get more fighters, good fighters, and a lot of them, then this plan is dead. You know it. I know it. Everybody fucking knows it. except for your boss and my parents.
Carmichael sighed heavily, grumpily. He had nothing else to say. When they arrived back at the Fresh Market, they found a familiar convoy of vehicles huddled under the awning of the loading docks. Carmichael gave Carol an appointed look over his shoulder.
Good. Maybe you can redirect some of your ire onto him instead of me.
Carolyn still looked at the three black GUVs, not knowing whether to feel pissed or hopeful or despondent. Absently, she said,
Carmichael, I've never blamed you.
He snorted like he wasn't so sure. Carolyn caught his eyes and tried to be earnest.
We're all just working for higher people. I know.
They found Richard Honeycutt inside the loading docks. He was with his usual entourage of bodyguards. Carolyn recognized two of them, a man and a woman. They had been the two that had captured her on the Raleigh-Durham maglev platform when she'd first come to Durham 2 weeks ago. Then there were a couple other muscleheads that she thought maybe she vaguely recalled, but it was hard to remember them as people. Mostly, they didn't do people things. They just stood around with large trapezius muscles and glared in random directions. There was one man among them that Carolyn was certain she'd never seen before. He was older and leaner than the bodyguards. He wasn't outfitted like them. He wore regular clothing, a blue button-down and gray khakis. He had a good-humored face, dark hair, the beginnings of a salt-and-pepper beard that just barely hid what looked like a solid beading that had mostly healed, a few scabby lines here and there from a cut that had closed over. The skin under his right eye was bright yellow and jaundiced-looking, a recovering black eye if she'd ever seen one. The man with the formerly beaten face gave her a polite nod and even the wisp of an amiable smile as she approached, but he said nothing. Honeycutt watched her stormily.
POC for all the operations in Durham, he said with barely restrained heat. And you go running off headlong into a full frontal fucking assault.
He shook his head.
Nice. Real smart.
Carolyn raised an eyebrow at him.
I'm surprised to hear such language, Mr. Honeycutt,
she replied, resting her hand on the butt of her gun.
I thought coarse language got you nowhere.
A lesson he had once tried to teach her. It didn't take. Honeycutt narrowed his gaze at her.
It has its place.
Then he flared his nostrils, took a sudden breath in which he seemed to dismiss the whole thing, and his face went back to neutral.
I've brought you a gift, Ms. Udy.
Carolyn glanced at the newcomer standing beside Honeycutt. She knew that's what Honeycutt was talking about, but she also wasn't going to give up an opportunity to press on other important matters as well.
Oh?
She asked.
Did you bring me some more fighters? Maybe some of the new breeds you've got hidden away?
Honeycutt smiled mirthlessly.
No, I brought you this gentleman here.
Carolyn turned to the man and extended her hand.
Well, you must be a hell of a fighter.
The man shook her hand and shook his head.
I can hold my own, but I certainly can't do the job of a squad of new breeds. Brad Hughes.
Carolyn almost said Carolyn, but stopped herself, managed to proceed with minimal hesitation.
Stephanie Udy. No offense, Mr. Hughes, but why are you here?
Honeycutt cleared his throat.
Mr. Hughes was a Fed agent until recently. Provided my organization with a lot of good intelligence over the last 18 months. Until he was outed, anyways. He picked District 89 to run to, which ended up being a poor choice as it got purged about 4 days after he went there to hide out. Mr. Hughes was captured by the Feds and then recaptured by some of Colonel Wainwright's men. So he's been around the block a bit.
Honeycutt drew in a deep breath.
I am hoping that Mr. Hughes, who has some intimate knowledge of coax operations in this region, might be able to help you strategize some effective local pressure points.
Carolyn nodded as she listened, processed it all.
I trust Mr. Hughes implicitly,
Honeycutt said, giving the man a sidelong glance and a nod.
Which is not something I say of many people, so I trust you won't take it lightly. I say this only because I know you to be as circumspect as I am. He is 100% trustworthy and in the clear.
Huh,
she said, then looked at Brad Hughes.
So you're going to advise me?
Hughes nodded. I have a strong background in cyber warfare, so I can probably help your tech team manipulate some of the Fed and coax networks a little better, which will make your life easier. But mainly I'm here because I may have some insights into some targets that might be beneficial to hit.
Another hacker, then. Fantastic.
Carolyn's eyes went back to Honeycutt.
In reference to the targets, who am I supposed to hit these targets with?
Honeycutt's nostrils flared, but he kept smiling, a smile that never touched his eyes.
Walk with me, Ms. Udy.
He He waved off his bodyguards. Carolyn fell into step with him. They went away from the central area of the fresh market, towards the front where all the empty shelving units had been piled up against the broad windows to offer some sort of ballistic protection, or at least a barricade to entry. When they were far enough away not to be overheard, Honeycutt spoke.
I'm not committing my men to a farce.
You said you would go along with the plan,
Carolyn hissed, not able to prevent herself from getting angry.
I said I would go along with the plan, provided that it did not constitute any undue loss on my part.
You're hanging me out to dry.
I'm doing no such thing.
I can't even get fighters from the Udies.
Honeycutt turned to her, raising a single triumphant eyebrow.
Mm-hmm. I'm well aware. And why should I sacrifice my men if the originators of this plan are not willing to sacrifice their own?
Because we both know that this is our best chance.
Honeycutt was noncommittal. Carolyn, he said, using her real name now that they were away from the others.
You need the renegades. Not more guerrillas, not more half-trained militias, not even men from my outfit. It won't do you any good, and we both know that, don't we?
He frowned at her, his own words piquing his irritation.
You keep requesting more men, but what do you think that's going to do for you? What do you think is going to happen to them? They're untrained in combat, going up against the best combat troops in the world. They're just going to get crushed like the others, except I'm going to be down a massive amount of manpower and a whole lot of goodwill.
He shook his head.
No, you don't need more men from me. You need the renegades. And it's not me that controls the renegades. It's your parents.
They won't commit them.
Well, perhaps you haven't given them an attractive enough target.
Honeycutt looked over her shoulder. She followed his gaze, saw Hughes standing there, leaning against a folded table with his hands in his pockets, just looking as casual as could be.
This is what I can do for you, Honeycutt said. I suggest you take advantage of it and do the best you can with what you've got.
It was Carolyn and Carmichael and Hughes in the loss prevention office. Three people standing in a huddle. The room was a critical mass, already starting to feel too warm from their body heat. Honeycutt had left the fresh market and taken his meathead bodyguards with him.
Hope you got something good for me,
Carolyn said, making it clear through her tone that she didn't think he did. Brad Hughes's lean figure was posted up across from Carolyn and Carmichael, almost like he was being interviewed. But he didn't seem to mind. He had a focused intensity that floated him above their doubts, and he seemed extremely interested in the task at hand. He nodded and began looking around the small room.
Yeah, I do.
Well, he shrugged. It kind of depends.
Depends on what?
He looked at Carolyn.
I'm sorry, can you project me a map of Durham, please?
He gestured to his bare forearm.
I haven't received a new one since my last was stripped.
Carolyn flipped up her PD and brought up the appropriate application, projecting it into the air and flipping it to be publicly viewed by all of them.
What does it depend on?
Carolyn repeated. Brad took a hold of the map projection and began panning it around, shoving their digital bird's eye view to the eastern side of the city, the green zone.
It depends on whether you can actually take the objective.
With just our militia fighters?
That's for you to decide, he said. I'm just here to provide intelligence. Think of me as a consultant, except I'm not scalping you financially.
He seemed to have found what he was looking for, and he stopped panning. Their vantage point now was hovering over the green zone. He began zooming in. Carolyn and Carmichael exchanged a glance. Carmichael was more comfortable with this than she was. Carolyn was distrustful as a default. Carmichael had a lot of faith in Honeycutt, and so if Honeycutt proclaimed Brad Hughes to be a gift, then that was how Carmichael was going to look at him.
So, to give you some background, Brad said, still speaking in a half-distracted way as he manipulated the map down to a street-level view and changed a few visual accessories. This place has been in Durham for a few years now, but it's been moved before.
He had zoomed into a specific block in the northeastern quadrant of the green zone. There was a large, circular white building there. He leaned away from the map and looked at Carolyn. It was still here last time I had access to updated intelligence, which, admittedly, has been a few weeks. And in that time, you guys have really turned Durham into a shithole. Point being, they may have moved it from this location to somewhere else, and if they have, I won't be able to tell you where that somewhere else is.
What are we even talking about?
Carolyn said, not bothering to hide her irritation.
The OLC, he said. And then, Office of the Liaison to the Coalition. Carolyn's mind flashed back to a vivid childhood memory. Her in her pajamas, eavesdropping as her parents convinced a crying man in their kitchen to go through with something, although she hadn't known what that something was at the time. But just about a week later, somebody in a suicide vest had walked into the office of the liaison to the coalition and blown himself up, and Carolyn was able to put two and two together. She took an unsteady breath.
I thought it was in Raleigh.
It was, Brad nodded, up to about 10 years ago. The rich Irbys in Raleigh didn't like all that coax business happening right alongside their own shady shit. Made a big stink. So the Fed moved the OLC to Durham, just far enough out of the way.
What do we want with a bunch of analysts and pencil pushers?
Brad nodded. Good question. We want nothing to do with them. However, he smiled and tapped a finger into the projected image, causing the building floating in the air in front of their faces to shimmer like a mirage. The OLC is a prime symbolic target. Because it doesn't have any strategic value, it's typically not guarded all that well. Although that may have changed since there's a war zone directly next door to it. Taking that shit over would not only be striking a hard blow inside their green zone, but would ruffle enough feathers and create enough waves that someone's head will be on the chopping block unless they snuff out the resistance in Durham. Carolyn frowned at him. Brad held up a hand. Obviously, we don't want to get snuffed out. But am I correct in assuming that kicking the proverbial hornet's nest is kind of the point here? Carolyn considered this for a long moment, unsure of how much Brad knew and how much she should tell him about the real reasons for the resistance operations in Durham. Eventually, she just nodded.
That's a good assumption. Go on. Tell me about something more than symbolic value, though. Give me something tangible.
Brad smiled. Right. Well, that's the best part. He looked at the image again the way a man looks at a lottery ticket that he really believes is a winner. Most transactions between the coax and the Fed occur electronically. However, one of the things that the coax likes to do is manipulate locals and offer bribes and rewards. No normal civilian wants to do an electronic exchange with its country's occupiers. It's a cash-only business. But it's a booming one. They pay for all kinds of stuff, and they pay a shit ton. So where does all that money come from?
The OLC?
Carolyn suggested. Yahtzee. Brad wagged a finger at the image of the building. There's a vault inside the OLC that contains millions of dollars, and it never goes empty, because the Fed keeps shoveling money into it because the coax keeps using it up so fast. It's a big, ridiculous cash circle, but that's another story. The point is, there's going to be multiple millions inside that OLC. Grabbing that is grabbing a whole lot of funding for the resistance, as well as throwing a monkey wrench into the coax's usual process. Brad held up his hands. Admittedly, they'll correct that pretty quick. But for probably a week, until shit gets sorted out, the coax won't be able to bribe, barter, or pay people off. Which, if you knew how much had happened, you'd know how much that will hurt them. Carolyn swallowed, thinking of the cash that her parents had received for selling Roy to the coax. Brad put his hands on his hips. Is that tangible enough for you? Carolyn didn't respond directly to him. She looked at Carmichael, who now didn't look quite so filled with faith. His face had become pursed, troubled. Carolyn crossed her arms over her chest.
So we're talking about a bank heist, basically.
Brad waffled his hands and bobbled his head, but then nodded. Okay, sure. Yeah, basically. He held up a finger, but one with some serious strategic value. He looked earnestly at her. If you're looking to goad the coax into something, a gesture at the projection, this is going to be your best bet. Carolyn took a long, deep breath. And then she stared at the image in the air for a long time as she exhaled.
Well,
she said finally,
I'm going to need to talk to the Udies.
Chapter 14. The safe house was far off the beaten path. They approached it with a cringing caution, and the house itself seemed to be waiting with that same tension that you might find in a spring-loaded bear trap. When they were about halfway down what must have been a quarter-mile-long drive into the woods, the trees cleared, and they saw the house sitting, nestled back in the corner of a meadow-like clearing, a sort of log cabin and stone construction. Very idyllic. Idyllic in that way that makes you think bombs are about to start going off at any moment. When Walter's PD chirped at him, he jumped hard. In the driver's seat, Harris stepped on the brakes, but didn't stop completely. Gibbs looked into the back, first at Walter and then at the PD. It was still chirping. An incoming call. Gibbs nodded.
You gonna answer that?
Walter flipped the monitor open and answered the call. There was no accompanying video feed, just a voice.
Is this Walter Balcom?
The voice asked. It was bored, old, gravelly. If an ancient arthritic bloodhound could speak in a human voice while sunning itself on a front porch, this is what it would sound like. Walter just stared at the projection in front of his face, and it seemed to take a full minute for him to figure out whether he was going to admit to that or not, even though it was only a few seconds. In those seconds, he imagined himself saying yes, and then the vehicle was immediately hit by a mini-bomb from above, or saying no, and the vehicle was immediately hit by machine gun fire from the house.
Yes, he said. What are you driving?
Walter's eye jumped over to Gibbs's. Gibbs nodded.
A gray Solar? Okay, gray Solar. Tell your driver to come to a complete stop.
He heard you, Walter replied. Harris pulled them to a stop. They sat there in the middle of the road. The sun had begun sinking into the afternoon, and now a patch of hotness was fixed on Walter's arm, baking him through the window. The leaves on the trees were still and without any movement from any sort of breeze. The long meadow grasses stood hushed and motionless.
Walter, the voice said, open your window and hold out your hand, displaying three fingers. Do it now.
Walter opened his window and stuck his right hand out, thumb, index, and middle.
You know what you need to say now, the voice prompted.
Walter stared blankly at the screen for a heart-palpitating moment and then said,
Firewalk? All right, the voice on the monitor said. Come on, pull into the garage.
Harris drove them forward. The gravel drive led them to a small, blacktop parking pad. The garage door was open on the side of the house. Closer now to it, Walter saw that it was prefabbed. The stone was not stone, and the logs were not logs, a bunch of polymers in disguise. It was a small house, but it looked well-maintained. There was a man inside the garage. He stood there, half-slouched, with his hands hanging at his sides and staring at them with droopy, hound-dog eyes. He was bald and his face shaven, save for a short, gray ghost of a goatee. He motioned them forward. They pulled into the garage, and he closed it behind them. The doors opened, and they all came tumbling out. The small Solar groaned and rocked as its chassis was freed from the burden of four new breeds. Walter was glad to be out of the cramped confines of the car, smashed in there with too many people and Bobby's booted feet laying on his lap. The old man in the garage watched them, and they watched him, and no one spoke at first. The old man scanned between Walter and Getty, and eventually, for some unknown reason, decided on Walter.
Must be you, he stated.
Yeah, was Walter's only reply. The man took one step forward and extended his hand. Walter took it. The hand was surprisingly firm. They gave each other a single pump and then released, very businesslike.
Name's Pete, he said. This is my house.
Your house? The man nodded once.
Yeah, mine.
Walter shifted his feet.
Don't worry, the man said, as though he'd had this conversation before. You're in the right place. Not every safe house is a shack owned by a straw company. Fact, contracted safe houses are might safer, but that's just my personal opinion.
He turned and started walking towards the door to the house, waving them on to follow him. The door from the garage opened up into the kitchen. The seven of them stood there, taking it in. Everything in the place was just like a normal home. There were pictures on the walls, there was comfortable-looking furniture, warm hues of paint. It smelled like coffee. This was the most inviting safe house that Walter had ever seen. Odd that his life led him down such a weird path now that he would be a connoisseur of safe houses. Looking out past the kitchen counter, Walter saw a dining room with a small table nestled up to a large window that looked out over the meadow and the driveway. On top of this table, there was a large sniper rifle laying on a bipod. Walter glanced at the old man and wondered if his shaky old man finger had been on the trigger when he'd been sighting on them coming down the drive. The thought made him angry, but he didn't say anything. The old man stopped on the far side of the kitchen and turned to them. He looked them over again.
Didn't realize there was gonna be so many of you.
He worked his mouth.
Didn't realize there were gonna be four new breeds.
Is it a problem? The man considered this for a moment.
No. He decided.
but I didn't pack enough food for them. I keep enough on hand for a couple people to last a couple days. Them boys will go through what I have in one sitting, and they look hungry.
He quirked a single white eyebrow.
You ain't been eating much, have you?
All four of the new breeds shook their heads.
Yeah. The old man nodded sagely. Once you're settled in, I can head back out to the store. Get a better haul.
Gibbs looked happy.
If you do that, we greatly appreciate it.
The old man seemed to take no notice. He looked to Walter.
Not enough beds in this house for seven. Only got three beds, besides my own. So some of y'all will have to sleep on the floor or couch. I don't care where you sleep. Don't truly care what you do. I only got two house rules.
He held up two fingers.
One, don't do nothing to call attention to us. This includes fighting, shooting, shouting, or spending too much time outside of the house. Two, don't go in my room.
Pete, the old man, turned and jabbed a finger at a door that was directly off the kitchen.
That's my room. Only room in the house that's off limits. Man's gotta have privacy.
Walter nodded. We understand. He looked to Bobby, who was leaning on Getty. Pete.
Yeah?
Do you know a doctor?
New one, he said. But he's gone now. Off to DTI, unfortunately. No more doctors that I trust. Sorry.
Walter looked at Bobby again, then at Getty. She needs TBI treatment. Getty nodded, frowning. Bobby didn't say anything. There was no point in denying it. She barely had the equilibrium to walk a straight line. Her brain had been shocked, and if it was left untreated, there were going to be all kinds of problems for her further down the road. Gibbs stepped forward.
I think we might be able to help with that.
No,
Macy said. And then, mustering more righteous indignation,
no!
Kaz clasped his hands together in the best impression he could muster of being a harmless humanitarian.
Macy, I understand how angry you are right now, but this lady got blown up. She could have serious brain issues if she's not treated.
They were all in the kitchen of the small apartment. Kaz and Javon stood at the entrance to the kitchen, kind of like a door-to-door salesman might loiter, half-restrained, outside your door. And at the small kitchen table, Macy hovered over James, who rubbed his red and swollen wrists and glared at Kaz with an unfathomable depth of hurt feelings.
She might even die, Kaz pressed.
Macy stopped pandering to James and closed her eyes, painfully conflicted. James seemed to notice that she wasn't soothing him anymore and glanced at her. His eyes widened when he saw that Kaz's words actually had some effect on her.
Macy, honey, you can't seriously be thinking about this.
Kaz's humanitarian hands clenched hard, the skin turning white. He set his teeth together and growled through them.
James.
Macy whirled on Kaz.
Why are you doing this to us?
She demanded.
First you come in and endanger all of our lives, begging for me to save your friend. And then when I do, you beat up my boyfriend and leave him bound and gagged in my fucking closet. And then you have the fucking nerve to ask me for more help? And you have the fucking nerve to try to make me feel guilty?
Her voice became shrill.
And you've already used his PD to contact God knows who, which means that the Fed is going to start investigating us, and all along you just plan to skate out of here and leave us to clean up the mess. You're such a selfish fucking asshole, Kaz. You stupid piece of shit. I can't believe I let you come back into my life after I finally got rid of you.
Macy breathed heavily. Her arms wrapped around her boyfriend's narrow shoulders, her eyes fixed balefully on Kaz. In the chair, apparently too weak to stand or do anything useful or be a man, James still sat, and he had the smug self-righteousness of a spoiled little boy hiding behind his mother's skirts. Javon shifted. He glanced at Kaz. He'd been around the fire-bearded man long enough to be able to read his face through the bush of orange that haloed it.
Kaz, Javon said, like you might call to a dog that has begun to growl and threaten a passerby on the sidewalk.
Kaz looked at his partner.
What? Why don't you take a break?
He blinked. A slight narrowing of the eyes. Javon nodded.
Go out on the back balcony. Get some fresh air.
Kaz's jaw muscles bunched rapidly under his beard for a 10 count, and then he nodded once and said,
okay.
He turned, as stiff as though he were in parade movements, and he marched out to the balcony adjacent to the kitchen. He opened the door, went outside, closed it behind him. Javon listened for the bolt to snick into place. Macy breathed a trembling breath.
Thank you, Javon,
she said.
I think he was about to get violent and—
Shut up, Javon said. Macy and James both looked at him, surprised.
Excuse
me? I said shut your fucking mouth.
Silence, and then two jaws snapped shut. Javon crossed to the kitchen table, and with his one good hand, he reached out, extracted one of the wooden chairs, turned it to face the huddled couple. Before sitting, he reached behind his back and under his shirt, and he drew out the pistol that he had there. And then he sat down in the chair, and he was very close to them, so that his knees were nearly touching James's. He leaned forward on his elbow, his forearm bridging the gap between his thighs, and the gun resting there, plainly visible. He looked at them, and there was nothing in his dark eyes at all except for a shark sort of predatory curiosity. Gone was the jocularity with which he normally masked himself.
First things first, Javon said, his voice quiet and conversational. If you cry out for Kaz or raise your voices in any way, shape, or form above what is necessary for a quiet, civilized conversation, I'll snuff you both out. Am I clear?
They both nodded, shrinking back. He turned to Macy.
I've already thanked you for saving my life. I've thanked you many times. I'll do it one more time. Thank you.
She just stared.
Say you're welcome.
You're welcome.
He nodded. Then he looked between the two of them.
Now listen very carefully, because I'm not going to argue with either of you. These are orders. You are going to help us. You are going to drive out to where our friends are, and you are going to help the lady with the TBI. You're going to do the best that you possibly can for her. And James, you're going to be there too, right, buddy? Because I don't trust you at all, so I'm going to keep you real close.
James's mouth worked like a grounded fish.
But how long are you going to keep me?
Javon smirked, then looked at Macy. Notice how he's not concerned at all about you?
Jesus.
He shook his head.
James, I'm going to keep you for as long as I need to, until I feel that I can release you without endangering myself or my friends or whatever our mission is. And you,
he wagged a finger at the man, his broad white teeth showing in an unfriendly grin,
just remember how fucking little you mean to me. At least Macy has some medical skills, and my boy Kaz is somewhat attached to her. But you, James, God, you're all liability and no reward at all. There's barely a reason for me to keep you alive. So I want you to think about that, okay? I want you to always remember how useless you are and how much easier my life would be if I just killed you.
James swallowed.
I'll remember.
Javon nodded. Yeah, do that. He sneered, disgusted.
The two of you may just be cows chewing cud, absorbed in your world of eating grass and shitting grass and moving on to more grass, but outside in the real world, there's a fucking war going on that somehow you haven't noticed. It's not a police action. It's not a few domestic terrorists run amok. This is a fucking war. And maybe you should both be thinking long and hard about whose side you're going to be on, because shit is going to escalate very quickly. I can promise you that. And when it does, there won't be any more fence sitters. Everyone's going to have to choose a side.
Macy raised her hands, and her face bore a false calm.
Javon, I'm going to help, okay? I'm going to help you willingly. You don't have to involve James. Leave James out of it, okay? I'll go. I'll help.
Javon just chuckled and looked at James.
Damn, son. You hear that? Macy's got twice the balls you got. She's in here sacrificing herself for you. And you just sit there.
Javon's half-hearted smile sank into a sneer again.
If that doesn't make your dick shrivel, then there's pretty much no hope for you.
James stared at him wide-eyed.
Well? Javon demanded.
James was momentarily confused.
Well, what?
Is your dick shriveling?
James's mouth hung open for a moment. Gradually, he closed it.
Yes?
Javon leaned forward.
Yes, what?
James closed his eyes at the indignity.
My dick is shriveling.
Javon leaned back and nodded.
Damn right it is.
He addressed himself to Macy.
Sorry, hon. The whole big happy family is coming on this road trip. But I admire your steely balls. That says a lot about you.
He gestured to James with the pistol.
You could do a lot better, you know.
Macy gave James a glance that, however brief, spoke volumes of shame.
Yeah, well...
Javon stood up from his seat. All right then, happy family. Remember everything I said. Can we do that? Silent nods. Javon turned towards the balcony doors. Kaz! Kaz lumbered in a moment later, somewhat calmer. He closed the door behind him. We good to go? Yeah. Javon stuffed the pistol back into his waistband, but not before Kaz had noted that it was in his hand. Let's all use the bathroom, he sang in a parental voice. No stops on this road trip. Chapter 15. How are you feeling? Walter asked. Bobby was lying on a bed, still bloody and smoke-stained, her clothes still on. The room was dim, the blinds closed. The headboard over the bed had a woodland scene of deer and quail and trees carved into it. Except for the scent of Bobby's sweat, the room smelled dusty and unused. Bobby had a frown on her otherwise soft face. When he spoke to her, she opened her eyes like a person with a bad hangover and squinted at him with a mix of irritability and confusion. Walter didn't think that was a good sign. After a second or two, she said,
What?
Are you feeling okay? Walter said. Do you need anything? She continued to look at him. Then her neck relaxed, and she looked at the ceiling, still with that slight frown. She had the look of someone who speaks very shaky English who is translating in their head.
Yeah?
She said after another moment.
Hey, I need...
Yeah?
I need to use the bathroom.
Oh, okay. She waited a moment, eyes going around the ceiling. And then she inclined her head again and looked at Walter.
I think I need help.
Walter wasn't sure what to do with that. He looked to his right, where Getty stood with his arms crossed, watching Bobby with an expression of uncharacteristic concern. He usually seemed so aloof about things, like nothing really mattered. Looking at Bobby, it seemed that it mattered. Getty cleared his throat. You need a cath or something?
No.
She let out an irritated breath and murmured something inaudible.
No, I just need help getting to the bathroom.
Another breath. A pause. Resting, as though the words had taken a lot out of her.
Things are still a little woozy. I don't want to fall.
Yeah, Getty said and stepped to the side of the bed. He helped her up. Walter started to move to lend a hand, but it seemed like Getty had it well in hand. She stood slowly, one arm clutching Getty's. She winced, and Walter could almost feel a migraine beginning behind his own eyes as he watched her cringe. She walked fairly normally, although it seemed that her body wanted to list to the right, and she kept steering into Getty, who calmly course-corrected her. The bathroom was attached to the bedroom. He got her to where she could brace herself on the counter.
That's fine,
she said.
I got it.
Getty left her and closed the door.
Don't go anywhere,
she called from inside the bathroom. We'll be right out here, he said. There was the sound of shuffling around. A long silence. Then the sound of a steady stream of pee. Walter scratched at his goatee, then looked at Getty. She's not acting like herself, he mumbled. Getty shook his head, agreeing with Walter. When she was finished, she made her own way out of the bathroom. She didn't ask for help, and Getty didn't presume. He just hovered next to her elbow as she made her way back to the bed.
Hot,
she mumbled.
What's that?
Getty asked. She slumped onto the bed.
It's hot. Can you turn the air down?
Yeah, I'll turn the air down.
She reclined gingerly, still with that slight frown. She was hurting and trying to hide it.
Sorry,
she murmured, but never specified what she was sorry for. Getty and Walter left the bedroom, left the lights off, closed the door.
Aren't you supposed to keep them awake?
Walter asked in a whisper outside the door. Getty shook his head.
Old wives' tale.
He'd already pulled out his pack of cigarettes and was making his way to the back door of the house. Pete the old man had told them to limit their time outside, but he'd also told them they were not to smoke in his house. Getty offered one to Walter, and Walter accepted. Pete the old man was gone, collecting enough groceries to feed the new breeds, and the new breeds had set up something of an impromptu command center in one of the bedrooms, where Walter could now hear them quietly conversing. He thought perhaps he should be in there, helping to figure out what the hell was going on and what the hell they were going to do about it, but he was too tired to think at the moment. And the sun hadn't even gone down yet.
It had been a long day so far, and his brain was blasted. Figuratively, anyways. Not literally, like Bobby's. They stepped out onto the back patio. The late afternoon sun shined brightly in their faces, and Walter felt a stab of an ache in his head, but it didn't last. Instead, it shifted. It went down like a shiver in his spine and nestled into his belly, made it feel stretched out and queasy. His shoulder throbbed absently. All the hubbub had caused the staples to tear just slightly, and the little kid's bandage had bled through and stained Walter's shirt. It was crusty and dried now. Red turned a deep brown. He didn't think he wanted the cigarette anymore. But Getty had lit his and held up the lighter for Walter, the flame still flickering. Walter lit it and drew in a drag.
"Hot out," he commented.
"Yeah," Getty nodded. They smoked in silence for a moment. The back patio was just a square of poured concrete, maybe a dozen feet on each side. There were two well-kept patio chairs and a small table between them with a potted plant sprouting colorful spade-shaped leaves. The lawn extended out past the patio, perhaps a whole acre of gently sloping terrain, and then it terminated in more trees. The trees surrounded them, kept them hidden like walls. Old growth, old hardwoods, kind of rare in North Carolina, where mostly what you found was scrubby pines.
"What am I doing here?"
Walter stared at it all like an alien world on which he was a trespasser.
"This is not you."
The cigarette hit Walter surprisingly hard. At least, that's what he told himself it was. His pulse knocked in his head, in his chest. He could feel a sweat that was not entirely due to the heat breaking out over his forehead. He felt his stomach turning over and over like it was tying itself in knots, and his hands had begun to tremble. He stubbornly took another drag, and when he pulled the cigarette out of his mouth, he frowned at the small length of it that was left. Suddenly the smoke tasted like acid. It drifted off the end of the cigarette towards his face, and he didn't want to smell it anymore. "Walt?" He turned and looked at Getty, who was eyeing him over the drifting smoke of his own cigarette. Walter tried to control the trembling of his hand, but his cigarette was dancing, the smoking zigzagging in the air.
"Yeah?"
he said, almost a wheeze.
"You look a little pale." "I don't feel so good," Walter said.
His heart was wild now, inexplicably rapid, which worried him, which made his heart beat even harder. He thought he heard something in the distance, and he snapped his head up to look at the skies. Getty seemed to know exactly what was happening. He didn't even look skyward. He just reached out a hand and plucked the cigarette out of Walter's fingers and stamped it on the ground. Then he laid a steadying hand on Walter's shoulder.
"Easy. Take it easy."
"You hear that?" Walter said, his words thick in his mouth. His mouth watered, sweated. It almost dribbled out of his mouth.
"Sit down."
Getty led him to a seat. Walter's vision darkled, sparkled. He allowed himself to be eased into one of the seats, but he didn't want to lean back. He needed to be doubled over. His body was telling him to make himself small. He wanted to be lying on the ground in a fetal position. He wanted to be in a small, dark space. He wanted to be safe. He planted his elbows on his knees, his breathing rapid.
"Slow down," Getty said, squeezing his shoulder. "It'll pass, okay? It'll pass. Try to breathe. Try to control your breathing."
Walter nodded and tried to breathe slower, but his lungs burned and his stomach swooned, and breathing rapidly made it feel marginally better. Breathing slow made it feel like he was going to die. He realized that his mouth was open. A string of clear, watery drool came out. Getty wisely moved himself to the side.
"It'll pass," he said, his voice steady, even.
Walter tried to stop himself, felt ashamed, even as it was happening, but the urge came upon him like a rush, like an inexorable ocean wave that you can't stop, can't do anything about but let it bowl you over. He vomited onto the ground. It splashed on the concrete, onto his shoes. Mostly bile, but some eggy-looking chunks from breakfast, which was the last meal he'd eaten that day. He strained as his stomach squeezed him down hard. When it relented, he coughed, tried to get a breath, got a half a gasp in, and vomited again. Only a little bit came out this time. Another gasp, another purge. Nothing this time. Getty kept telling him that,
"It'll pass. Trust me, it'll pass."
It did. After another two repetitions of his confused stomach trying to get everything out, it finally released its death grip on his core, and a wash of relief came over him, making him feel suddenly cold. He was soaked with sweat, spluttering, but breathing. Getty was silent now, squeezing his shoulder, and it felt so odd to receive that from Getty, who was always so distant.